As more people arrive, just a reminder, don't sit in the last four rows and sit wherever you'd like otherwise, and your profs will find you. There's a lot of seats up here, and we could use people up in this front section. Lots of seats up front. Please come forward. right, good morning, everyone. We decided to make your instructors work extra hard this morning to take attendance by not having you sit in sections, but we are asking you to move forward, and profs, I'll invite you, for those yet to come, to move them towards the front where we have plenty of space. Welcome, everyone. It's really exciting to have this opportunity this morning to meet the author of our first primary text, Ponds of Kalambayi. You were here last night for his public lecture on climate change, and he is giving another talk at 10 a.m. on the same topic, but with the focus on what young people can do to change an old debate. We've asked him this morning to focus on the book, and I sent Mike a set of discussion questions that Keith Graber Miller wrote a few years ago when we first started using the book. This is the third year we're reading it. And Mike was telling me this morning how impressed he was with these questions, and it really gave him insight into what we're asking you to think about. He's going to share a few stories, a bit about why he wrote the book, but a good portion of our time will be for your questions. So I really want to encourage you to ask questions when that time comes and get a conversation going. A couple of us will be holding mics that will run around, but I think it'll also be fine to stand up and speak very loudly since it's a smaller group this morning. Mike Tidwell is executive director of Chesapeake Climate Action Network. He's written 5 books. This was his first, and he'll tell us more about how it came to be. And he is incredibly involved in policy creation and advocacy and change. And we have a lot to learn from him about what has inspired his current work and what we can do to help him change the world when it comes to climate change and extending as far as the people he met in Central Congo 20 years ago. Please join me in welcoming Mike Tidwell.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Beverly Lapp, for that great introduction. It's great to be here with you guys in the great state of Indiana, here at Goshen College. I always feel weird talking about being the center of attention. I usually like to put other people at the center of attention, policymakers, you know, who can change this world, and advocating and lobbying them. So it's a little bit of a reversal for me to be here, maybe taking your questions in a moment. But I do want to talk about this book. Most of you have read most of it, I think. I actually wrote this book when I wasn't that much older than you guys. So it's very interesting for me when I go back and read the kind of things that were going through my head at a very young age, asking a lot of the similar questions that many of you are asking of yourselves. You know, who am I? How do I fit into the world? What matters? What's really important? What do I want to do with my life? These are all the questions that I, as a person in my 20s, struggled with and grappled with in this book, and both joyful and painful ways. But I wanted to begin by just telling a story that in my mind sort of summarizes my early experience in the Congo and what it was like to go from being a moderately naive 22-year-old suburban kid from Atlanta to the middle of absolutely nowhere in the Congo. I was a fisheries volunteer with the Peace Corps. I taught people how to raise fish. It was pretty basic technology. If you think about it, when you're in a developing country without a lot of sophisticated, modern, complex infrastructure, whatever your development strategy is, it's got to be fairly simple. It's got to be something that can be replicated by people that can be achieved by using local tools and local resources. And so our program was pretty straightforward. We would go into villages and find a small stream or a spring on a hillside, build a very simple canal that would allow, through gravity flow, the water to flow into ponds that were dug by hand with shovels. And that was the basic technology. Then you would stock the fish, the ponds with local fish, and then harvest them 6 months later. So my job was a fish culture extension agent. I had a Yamaha 125 Enduro DT dirt bike. And I would go through all these villages over a 400 square mile area in an area called Kalambai in central Congo. At first I don't think I really appreciated how I must have appeared to the local people, and I certainly didn't appreciate the rhythms of life and the interactions between people there versus where I was from. I was on my motorcycle, I remember, early one morning. I had earlier in the week gotten a young man named Ilunga, who had come to my house and said that he wanted to raise fish, and that he lived in a distant village, and that he gave me basic directions how to get there, and could I come visit him on Wednesday morning, 3 days from now. And I said, sure, and I took down some notes of where the village was, and I said, I'll be there early Wednesday morning. So I got on my motorcycle that early morning, and only motorized vehicle in the entire area, 400 square miles, got on my motorcycle, my loud motorcycle, and I roll into this village, Kabamba's village. But keep in mind that basically every village there looks exactly the same. It's just radical egalitarianism. Everybody is poor. Everybody has houses built the exact same way, mud walls, thatch roof. And at first, when you get there, it is very hard to get oriented. It's hard to know exactly where you are because everything looks the same. And so I'm rolling through this village early in the morning on my motorcycle, and in the distance, and I can't find Kabamba's house or Ilunga's house, and in the distance I see these two older gentlemen, white-haired elders, taking a morning walk. And they're in the distance and they're just walking like this, side by side, taking their morning walk. And I decide, oh, I'm going to ask them for directions. Where does Ilunga live? So I roll up on my motorcycle really loud. I've got this banana yellow crash helmet on, a bell crash helmet that covers part of my face. I've got these leather riding gloves. My motorcycle is really, really loud. I have goggles on. I have my Caucasian skin that stands out in this African society. Loud motorcycle, these two elder gentlemen. I pull up right next to them on my motorcycle. I don't even bother to turn the motorcycle off. And I just yell to them, do you know where Ilunga lives? And these gentlemen look at each other and then look back at me and then look at each other and then look back at me, and they say, good morning to you too. And I just was flooded with this sense of incorrectness and shame. Of course I should have said good morning to these men. Of course they were my elders. Of course I was being rude. So I turned off the motorcycle. I took off my helmet. I got off the motorcycle. And I greeted them the way people there always greet each other all the time. Shake hands. Hello. How are you? How is your family? How are your crops? Is everyone well? Is anyone sick? You go through a whole series of questions and you acknowledge each other. You recognize each other. You validate each other. Because in this culture, people matter, relationships matter, community is paramount. And I'd come from a society where that wasn't the case, where community wasn't paramount, where relationships weren't paramount, where you would just pull over in a car somewhere in the suburbs and roll down your window to a stranger and say, hey, do you know where 7125 Willow Avenue is? And they'd say, yeah, it's down there somewhere. And you'd never greet that person. And it was really revealing to me early in this experience as a Peace Corps volunteer of what was different about this community. And it provided for me insights into where we come from as people, how we evolved. For the vast majority of human history, people and relationships were paramount. Communities we're all important. And there was a sharing and a mutual support and a mutual strength that came from those close, respectful bonds that I think have been diluted in a modern American culture. And that is part of the problem of the insensitivity that we have in our communities and the fact that in modern communities, we don't always take care of everybody. And some people do get left behind. And so this was just part of the many, many experiences that I had, the sense of new identity, of rediscovering who I was and who I wanted to be able to live in a place overseas where I could compare what I was seeing there with the world that I grew up in, and then being able to fit together the best of different worlds and coming up with what I hoped would be a better composite of who I wanted to be. And these are some of the experiences. This is what this entire book is about. It's about those discoveries and those surprises and those challenges and those moments of pain and setback, but also joy and accomplishment. I want to just touch on a few other questions, and then I just want to give you guys a chance to ask me some questions. You know, the best question I think that you can ask an author, and one of the first questions you should ask an author, is why did you write the book? You know, why did you write the book? First of all, writing a book is really hard. And people think that authors, I've written 5 books now, they think that, oh, you've written 5 books. You're lucky. Writing's easy for you. You get writing done. And the reality is, I hate writing. I hate it. It's homework. It just feels like homework all the time. It's really, really hard. But it's also so rewarding. You know, it's sort of like what mountain climbers say when they get off of Mount Everest. It sure feels good when you stop, you know? It sure feels good when you're done, the sense of accomplishment. That's what writing is like for me. So it's very hard, and for me to sit down and write a whole book, I have to be really, really motivated because it takes so much dedication, so much time, so much work. So why did I write this book? Well, I had these amazing experiences for 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer, life-changing experiences. And then I came back to the United States. I went back to that suburban community in Atlanta with all the fast cars and the space shuttle program and bridges and skyscrapers. And I came back and I had all these stories about these tiny villages in the middle of nowhere in Africa, and I started telling my stories. I started telling people about Alunga and my friends and the hunger and the poverty and the sense of community and the great friends that I had and all the amazing things that I experienced. And after 3 days, I was still talking, but all my friends and relatives, their eyes were starting to glaze over a little bit. You know, they were sort of like, okay, you've talked to us a lot for several days, and now you're back, and that's great. We really don't have time to hear a lot more. And I was just getting started, you know, with my stories. And I experienced this profound frustration. Like, I had so much that I had learned, so much that I wanted to say, and I had to figure out a way to do it. And that's when I realized I needed to write it all down. I needed to write it down in a book. And, you know, most writers, if they'll be honest, when they're honest, they will tell you the number one reason writers write is for themselves. Writers write books because they can't not write it. There's a restlessness. There's a drive that won't allow them to walk away from an experience. I was not able to come back to the United States and let this experience go. I had to sit down and write it out because it was so important to me. And also, I wasn't sure when I came back exactly what I thought. I had not quite sorted out the experiences. I hadn't interpreted what it all meant to me. And I knew that I had to do that. I was too restless. I couldn't go on with whatever the next phase of my life was going to be, grad school, get a job, whatever it is. I couldn't go on to that next phase until I dealt with this issue, this story. So I sat down and I wrote the book. And I did it mostly for me because I had to do it psychologically, spiritually. I had to do it. And then in the book, I came to terms with all these experiences. And it helped me grow as a person. The experience of being in Africa as a Peace Corps volunteer helped me grow. The experience of writing about it, meditating on it, and then giving whatever lessons were there to other people was also a great experience for me. I have to say that I learned a lot. I learned a lot about generosity, what it means to really give and to care about other people. One of the stories in the book that you guys will remember is the fact that people in this society who have so little give so much. And it's the same in the United States. If you look at studies on philanthropy, they show that the poorest Americans give the largest portion of their income to others. People with the most amount of money, on average, give the least amount to charities in this country. Those who have the least give the most. And I think it's because when you don't have much, you understand what it's like not to have much. You have compassion for others. You understand what it means to need help when you don't have much, and therefore you understand the responsibility to give help. And that is what this society was entirely based on. And when I came and wanted people to raise fish and grow fish, I wanted them to sell those fish and use that money to buy supplies for their kids, to repair their roof, to buy medicines for their sick loved ones. But instead, after people would harvest these fish, they would wind up giving most of it away to their extended family, and it drove me crazy. It's like, well, you worked so hard to raise all these fish. Now you can eat them and sell them, and your immediate family can prosper. But that's just not the way it works there with these big extended families. And every village was basically one big extended family. And so when anyone had a certain sudden surplus of anything, corn, fish, firewood, whatever it is, it was shared freely and totally. And it was a problem. It was a problem in that it was partly a source of the poverty. It led people from being too focused on getting more, a lot more, because the incentive to do a lot more and to have more things was diluted in part by knowing that you would then have to immediately redistribute those things. But it was a great survival strategy in that it meant that nobody was left behind, that if anyone had any food, everyone had food. And these were some of the struggles I had to deal with as an American from a capitalist society where private property is, you know, a paramount value. You don't share. You don't give freely among each other the way you do in this society. So those two worldviews clash in this book. And again, I have to figure out for myself, well, what do I really think? What do I really feel? What makes the most sense for me based on the experiences I'm now having? And so I learned a lot about the issue of generosity. I also learned what it means to be grateful, to really be grateful. I have lived among people who are hungry. I've seen what it's like for a woman, a mother of 6, 7, 8 children, put a bowl of food on the ground for those kids that is not enough food. I've seen those kids grab for that food, get a small handful, even though I know they're hungry. I know what it's like to be around people who, during famine and before the corn harvest come, lose weight, complain of headaches, have weakness, are more prone to illness. I've seen this with my own lives. I attended over 200 funerals in 2 years. 200 funerals in 2 years as a Peace Corps volunteer. 3/4 of those funerals were for children under the age of 5. I've seen children, held them in my own arms, children dying of curable diseases, of measles, of mumps, of diarrhea, curable diseases, and perish nonetheless because of the poverty. All of this inbred in me and has given to me a lifelong deep sense of gratitude. I cannot sit down to a single meal, no matter how simple it is, whether it's a piece of bread or a full 4-course meal, it doesn't matter. Every meal I have sat down to since I came back from Peace Corps, I am flooded with gratitude that I have this food in front of me. It doesn't go away, every single meal. So it taught me gratitude. It also gave me a sense of accomplishment and a confidence to do more in my life. There's a passage in the book where I'm at a river crossing, and I'm having to get my motorcycle across a river in a canoe, and I'm waiting for the canoe operator. He's on the other side of the river, and I'm waiting for him to come back so he can ferry me across. So I'm sitting on this riverbank by myself, and all of a sudden, this older gentleman, this husband and wife show up. They're in their 70s or 80s, very old people, And the husband sits down next to me, and the wife wanders off down the river to collect some goats down the way. So I'm sitting next to this man, just me and this old guy, and he is aware that I'm there. He greets me in Chiluba, the language there, and I greet him, and I look over, and I see that his eyes are completely covered over with cataracts, and that he's completely blind. And this is after I'd been in Columbine in this area for about a year. I'd struggled with the language and the customs and the whole culture. But I'd been there for about a year, and I was starting to get the hang of things. And this older gentleman started talking to me, and he started talking to me in a very interesting way. He asked me where I was from. You know, he said, "What village are you from?" And I said, "Oh, I live in this village over here." And he started asking me, how my day was going and where I was going later. And it became clear to me suddenly that he didn't realize that I was American, that I was speaking Chiluba well enough that he thought it was just, you know, a version of a dialect. He was from the next region, and he had no idea that I was an American, a Caucasian, someone from the equivalent of outer space. And it was just a profound experience to realize that for the first time I was there, I wasn't being judged by the color of my skin or the history of my culture, but I was sitting there with an old gentleman having a total cross-cultural, genuine experience, and it was a sense of gratitude. So these are some of the things that I write about in the book. These are some of the ways that this experience helped me grow. These are some of the issues that I dealt with as a writer. And I will tell you that my experience as a Peace Corps volunteer still shapes me, affects me every day. It's led me in the direction of my life that I've gone. It's led me in a direction of service. It's deepened my sense of faith and my own Christianity. It's given me a sense of community and interconnection with other people that I don't think I would have had. And it's made me a climate activist. It's made me feel a responsibility to do more in the world, to help the world's poor and to protect all people from the ravages of pollution and injustice. So it is an experience that keeps giving. It is a book that I'm glad continues to give on college campuses like this. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you guys have.
Raise your hands if you have questions. Keith and I will pass the mic around.
Hi. You said that this experience has deepened your faith in Christianity, and when I read your book, I didn't get an overwhelming sense of your faith in the book. Is this a change that happened since you came back?
That's a great question, and I got the same question last night. So the question is, my expression of Christian faith here right now isn't as reflected in this book. The story I told last night on this same stage was I was born a Southern Baptist into a Southern Baptist family in Georgia, went to a very conservative Southern Baptist church growing up, and I mean, my family was all in to this church. Sunday morning, Sunday school, choir. We'd go to church again on Wednesday evenings. But then when I was 13 years old and starting to think for myself and starting to have my own opinions and to question received wisdom, I told my parents, one Sunday morning came along and I told them, I'm not going. I'm not going to church. And they were like, "What do you mean you're not going? You got to go. This is what we do. We go to church on Sunday morning." And I said, "No, you know what? That church we've been going to my whole life, I don't think it's for me." "Well, what do you mean it's not for you? You got to go." I said, "No, you know what? Here's my problem with this church. The dominant emotion that I feel and that I associate with that church is fear. Fear of God, fear of sin, fear of doing wrong." And I said, "You know what? I don't like that feeling. And it doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. It doesn't seem to be the way that you should practice religion." So I stopped going to church at a young age, but I continued to have, in retrospect, I know, I continued to have that Christian seed in me, that made me attuned to the message of Jesus Christ. I would go to church with friends on Easter and Christmas who would invite me, and I enjoyed it, but I still, for 20 years, in my 20s and early 30s, I thought, it's still not for me. But then in my early 30s, I found my way back to the church, and I found the right church home for me. I'm a Presbyterian now, very active in my church. My son is the age of many of you. He's a freshman at College of Worcester, a Presbyterian college in Ohio. He grew up in a church. So I for 20 years, I was a recovering Southern Baptist, and now I've found my way back.
Hi. One of the big points of discussion that had a lot of controversy while we were talking about the memoir was, in one passage you wrote, "All the men stuck tenaciously to the view that accidents and free will play no role in steering human life, that God controlled events, or if not him, then some black magic spirit, and if not that, then something else, the soul of a deceased ancestor, perhaps. I considered it a failure that in 2 years I'd been unable to alter the views of even one farmer in this respect." Some people during this discussion considered it that it should not have been a failure at all because that wasn't what he was there to do. He wasn't getting paid to westernize Columbine or the Congo in any way. He was getting paid to teach fish culture. What is your take on that, that you consider it a failure and that other people disagree with that?
Really good question. It is very, very hard for us to appreciate the degree to which superstition and a belief in, call it what you want, magic, sorcery, whatever. It's hard for us to understand the degree to which that has been at near the center of human worldview. You know, before the dawn of science, before the Renaissance and our abundant knowledge that we have today, superstition ruled human society, and it still rules many lesser developed countries. And in these villages that I lived in, it was just amazing to me how nothing was considered an accident. If something bad happened, it was because somebody was putting a curse on you, a black magic curse on you. If your kids got measles, it's because there were these small demons, that invisible demons that would travel from village to village and would go up in the roof of your house at night if you didn't have the right talisman, if you didn't have the right, you know, protective curse put on your house, they would sprinkle measles on your children. I mean, this world, everything was part of this invisible world of superstition and black magic, and it is truly a crippling worldview because it leads you down pathways where solutions are very difficult. And so there were some people who wouldn't raise fish ponds, for example, in a certain valley because they said, oh no, my grandfather was killed by bad spirits in that valley. And it turns out it's the only valley near their village where fish ponds were possible. And so even though I wasn't there to proselytize people, I wasn't there to make them, you know, true believers in the religion of science or the religion of Christianity, that's not why I was there. I was there, however, to try to improve the material well-being and the health of people and their children. And this belief in superstition and black magic got in the way all the time and made my job a lot harder. Now, there is the matter that one should be respectful of other people's cultural beliefs, and this book is full of a lot of celebration of these wonderful different cultural attributes in this region, but that was the belief in this invisible other world was a problem, and was holding people back in many ways, so that was a struggle for me in that context.
Hi, Mike, you are now in your early 50s. So what is your perspective, or how could you describe 22-year-old Mike in this book?
What is that last part?
How will you describe 22-year-old Mike, the one who wrote this book?
Well, as I say in the new introduction that I wrote in 2011, there's a famous quote by L.P. Hartley, a writer who said, "The past is like a foreign country. People do things differently there." And think about that. When you look at a photograph of yourself as a young child, it's like you're looking into another world. You're looking into a foreign country, and everything was different there. And now imagine if your past, part of your past, actually took place in a foreign country. And that's, you know, as I look back at this book and I look back at the young man who had this experience, it is really fascinating to me. I see a young person, again, like perhaps some of you here today, who was full of more questions than I had answers, who was a little bit naive, didn't know what I was getting into, who was, I'm really blown away by how courageous I was, courageous/naive, to do the things that I did. I look back at this young person and I'm really glad he lived through it, you know, and didn't drown or wreck his motorcycle. You know, I read this book and I see who I was at 22 and I think I would never let my son join the Peace Corps and go to the Congo. And of course, if he decides he will, I won't hold him back. So it's an interesting experience for me, and I'm inspired by the story. It created for me a lifelong, this character who's me in this foreign country of the past still speaks to me and challenges me to stay courageous and to keep pushing and to keep asking questions. And that's who I see here.
Hello, Mike. I'm excited to see you today. When I read your book, and then I got emotional in the aspect when you talked about Mbaya. You told us how much he was loyal to you and everything he did to you, everything he did for you to help your survival in Kalambai. And you knew that diamonds prospecting was very dangerous. You told us how people died. And then when you were leaving, he was going to do diamond prospecting, and you allowed him to go knowing that he might not come back alive. Then you said you were naive then. I'm wondering if it were now that somebody that helped you so much and helped you to survive, would you let him go ahead to do diamond prospecting knowing that maybe the next minute he might be dead? Is it because you were naive then? Is there anything you would have done differently right now, considering your experience and your age right now? That's one of my questions. I have two questions. Another one is, talking about the language, you said you were very fluent. That was very good. But I'm wondering, you said you talked to the old man at the stream and the man could not recognize, couldn't know whether you were from the village or not because you were very fluent in your language. Was that your own rating of your fluency? Because I'm wondering how you could go to a strange country and you're learning a strange language for the very first time and you can be very fluent in all the sentences that nobody can identify that this is a foreigner. I'm wondering, was it your own rating of fluency or was it like a general rating of your own fluency of the Shuluba language?
You know, I think the microphone is distorting a little bit. I didn't hear that last part, that second question.
Okay,
why don't you hold the microphone down and ask
Did you hear the first question about Mbaya? Or can I say it again?
I got the Mbaya question.
Okay.
But I tell you what, take the microphone, pull it away, and ask me.
Okay. I said about the language fluency. You said you were very fluent in Shiluba language, that the old man at the stream could not recognize that you were not from Kalambai. So I'm wondering, was it your own rating of the fluency of Shiluba language, or was it like a general rating? Because I'm wondering how you could go to a foreign country for the very first time and you learned a new language and you were able to be very extremely fluent in 2 years, that nobody could identify that this was like a foreigner. You didn't have any kind of accent in the language. And then I'm wondering, was this your own rating of fluency, or was it like everybody knew you were so fluent that they could not identify that you had any kind of accent?
Sure,
or anything?
Sure. So I'll take the second question first. The question is, were you, to what degree were you fluent in this foreign language, Tuluba, so much so that somebody who was blind could still nonetheless tell that you weren't from a foreign country? First of all, I was extremely fluent in Tuluba because every day I would wake up and there was nobody around to speak English to at all. I had to learn this language. I was just dropped in the middle of this region where I had to sink or swim. If I wanted to get anything done, to buy anything in the market, to express myself to farmers, to teach them how to dig fish ponds, I had to become fluent in Tuluba. By the end of my 2 years, I could go anywhere in a village, go up to anybody's house, find the smallest little tool, the smallest little artifact, anything that people use, you know, hair ribbons, whatever, and I could tell you the name of each one of those things. I would dream in Tuluba. I would dream in this language. You know you're really immersed in a language when you start to actually dream in that language. So in my dreams, everybody was speaking Tuluba. I had an experience where toward the end of my 2 years, I was listening to the radio. I had a shortwave radio, and I would try to find the Voice of America or BBC, something in English. Now, keep in mind that every day I was speaking Tuluba all day long. I also had some friends who were teachers who spoke French, so I would speak French with them. And then my only encounter with English was on the radio, and I would read. I would read books in English. So I had these three different languages, mostly Tuluba flowing through me, some French, and also English from radio. And I remember toward the end of my 2 years, at night I was tired. I didn't want to read. I was too tired to read. I turned on my shortwave radio. I was trying to find broadcast in English that I could listen to, and I'm turning and I hear French and I hear Tuluba and I hear some other languages, and then finally I find a station in English. So I tune it to that and I'm listening to this broadcaster in English, but a few moments go by and I'm listening to this broadcast and I'm thinking, is that English? Is he speaking in English? And I went through this panic, like, it sounds like English. Why am I not understanding it? And then I realized it was Afrikaans, right? It was the language of South Africa, which is like a Dutch-English combination. And I realized, oh my God, I have no language base in my brain, you know? I mean, I'm all over the place so that I don't even recognize sometimes whether people are speaking English or Afrikaans. So it was that intense, the language component. So when I met this gentleman after being there for a year, I was completely fluent in Tuluba. But there were many different dialects. You know, there were people who would live in Kalambay who would speak Tuluba a little bit differently than the people who would live in the next region, even just 20, 30, 40 miles away. And the people who'd live another 20 or 30, 40 miles away would speak with a slightly different accent of Tuluba and use slightly different words. And this gentleman thought I just had a slightly different dialect. So when he heard my accent or when I would say things maybe not 100% correct, he just thought, oh, that's the way they speak it in Kalambay, when he was from the neighboring village. In terms of Mbaya, the young gentleman who's a major character in this book, and he was my helper, because there was no electricity, no running water, in order for me to be able to work, to do my job, I had to have someone help me draw my water from the river, wash my clothes, buy my food, and have a helper. And Baya was my helper, and he became tantamount to my brother, an amazing young man who, I mean, that was a friendship the likes of which I never expect to have again in my life. But then there was a moment in the book where he needs to get money to pay the bride wealth for a new wife. He needed a lot of money. He needed the equivalent of, I don't know, several hundred dollars, which is an unfathomable fund. And he decided he would go do diamond digging in these dangerous diamond mines in a nearby region. And it's very, very dangerous. So the question, as I understand it, is, was that the right move to let someone who was so close to you, a close friend, someone you cared about, go and do something so dangerous for pay? And would I do it differently now? Maybe I would. The thing that's hard to do in this life is to see people in other countries, in other cultures, and assume that you know what's best for them based on your values and your culture. It is very hard to get completely inside a culture and totally understand other people's experiences. Sometimes what we see as things that absolutely seem to not make sense to us as Westerners looking in, from their perspective, does make sense and is worth the risk. So in my young age of just being 23, 24 years old at the time, I had sort of gone native in a way. I had adopted the local culture, the local values, the local language, and I had started to have the same sort of sense of appropriate risk, so that when my friend Abaya said, I want to go dig for diamonds in these mines that routinely collapse, people would be injured, some were killed, very, very dangerous. When he came to me and said he wanted to do it, I was persuaded by him that he was doing the right thing. Would I do it differently now as I'm a little older and wiser? Probably. But complex question. Good question.
Hi. In our group, we were particularly interested in your relation with Mabaya, and we were wondering if you have had any contact or know what happened to him after you left.
Mm-hmm. So did I stay in touch with Mabaya after I left? I tried. I tried very hard. It's hard to imagine just how... just what a lack of basic infrastructure is there in the Congo. Mail service is virtually impossible. If your letter ever actually arrived there, chances are it would be opened by, the post office people, and whatever letter or money or whatever you put in it would be taken out. So I did find a way to send letters to a Presbyterian missionary that I had met, who from time to time would go into Columbia or would give a letter to someone trustworthy to take. And I exchanged letters with Mbaya, and I started to send him money. There's no banking system. There's no way to send money except by cash. And I would begin to send money to help him. He did finally get a wife. But then he started to write me back and say that even the cash that I would send through this missionary somehow would wind up being delivered to an uncle of his. Maybe Mbaya was in the fields and the uncle would receive the letter, and by the time Mbaya got back from the fields, the money was gone. So that just became very, very difficult, but we continued as best we could. And then in 1991, a war began. The dictator was removed. There was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of unrest. The Peace Corps pulled out of Zaire in 1991. A lot of the missionaries left. And then contact became very, very hard for a long time. Then only recently, with the advent of cell phones in the last 5 years, I've started to get cell phone calls, from people in Columbia who would, buy 5 minutes of cell phone time, save up the money and buy and then call. And I've been in touch. But the first cell phone call that I got 5 years ago, I had not been in touch with Mbaya for about 5 years prior to that. So it had been quite a while. And I learned that he had passed away. He had passed away at the age of 46, I think, which in a country where the life expectancy is 49, I mean, it's hard to imagine that, but even today in 2015, there are countries in this world where life expectancy isn't even 50. I've grieved over that, and it's just a reminder to me of the level of poverty in this world that we have to work together to try to eradicate.
Yes, if you could live in any country in Africa, what would be your top 2 or 3 choices?
Oh, well, unfortunately, I've only been to a handful. I would love to live in the Congo again. I mean, beautiful area, the grasslands, the rolling grasslands of the high savanna of central Congo, where I live, was just remarkably beautiful. The wildlife, the migratory birds that I was able to see there, the open space, the wild animals, it was just remarkable. The remnants of jungles and riverine habitat, hippos, I saw hippos, crocodiles, just an amazingly beautiful landscape. I've been to Tanzania, Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Sudan. I'd have to say of those countries that I've been to, probably the Serengeti region of Kenya certainly is fantastic. And Ethiopia as well. I mean, the highlands of Ethiopia, just beautiful landscape, beautiful people, excellent food. I'm an Ethiopian food addict. So those would be some of my top choices.
Most of my question was about Mbaya that Katie already asked, but have you been back to Kalambayi, and what has been your reasons behind going back or not going back?
I've not been back. I've wanted to go back, and I am envious of Peace Corps volunteers who serve in, for example, Central America, in Costa Rica or Honduras. It's very, very easy to return back to your place where you served. Many volunteers, even in, you know, the Philippines, Thailand, there are a lot of places in the world where Peace Corps volunteers have historically served that are pretty easy to return to. The Congo is not one of them. Since I left, the degree of poverty, the degree of isolation, the long war that went on there for many years prevented me from going back. And then my son was born in 1997, and I mean, if I were to go back to my village, I would have to fly to Zaire in a corrupt, chaotic capital run by a dictator, then take a domestic flight from Kinshasa, the capital, to the regional capital of Mbujimayi. The domestic airline at the time that I was there was called Air Zaire, but the joke was that in French they called it Air Petetre, which means air maybe. Air maybe you'd get there. And the air service is even worse now. And then you'd have to get in a Land Rover and go for 200 kilometers over terrible roads all the time. No telephones, no hospitals, you know, no infrastructure, rampant malaria. I just couldn't see myself doing that while I had a dependent child back in the United States. But I do think that I'll go back. Before my time is done on this planet, I'm going to go back. I don't know when, but I think about it every day.
I think our time is about up. Are there any closing words you'd like to give us?
Well, I would say, I know almost all of you, a great percentage of you, will study abroad during your time at Goshen, and I know that you'll have amazing experiences. I hope that this book helps you think about that experience and the kind of questions and the kind of things you want to get out of that experience. And I would also encourage you to consider the Peace Corps when you get out of college or some other service organization to live for a year or two overseas helping people who are in need of help, whether it be through the church or through Peace Corps. Peace Corps is an amazing program. All the Democratic candidates for president right now are declaring that they want to expand the Peace Corps. They want to send more young Americans overseas. So there's a great opportunity there. It was great for me. It's the most important thing that I've done in my life. It has taught me more and given me more than any other single experience in my life. And I encourage you to consider it in your future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. We have about a 10-minute break, and then Convo begins in here for another talk with Mike. Thank you.